gave more, and she stumbled. Her grandmother didn't miss a beat. She struck. Not with her nails or teeth, but with her foot. The kick to Manon's stomach set her screaming, a roar again answered by Abraxos, locked high above. Soon to die, as she would. She prayed the 13 would spare him, let him join them wherever they would flee. Manon slammed into the stone rail of the balcony and crumpled to the black tiles. Blue blood leaked from her, staining the thighs of her pants. Her grandmother slowly approached, panting. Manon grabbed the balcony rail, hauling herself to her feet one last time. "Do you want to know a secret, Kinslayer?" her grandmother breathed. Manon slumped against the balcony rail, the drop below endless and a relief. They'd take her to the dungeons, either use her for Erewhon's breeding, or torture her until she begged for death. Maybe both. Her grandmother spoke so softly that even Manon could barely hear over her own gasps for air. "As your mother labored to push you out, she confessed who your father was. She said you would be the one who broke the curse, who saved us. She said your father was a rare-born Kraken prince, and she said that your mixed blood would be the key." Her grandmother lifted her nails to her mouth and licked off Manon's blue blood. "No. No." "So you have been a kinslayer your whole life," her grandmother purred, "hunting down those Krakens, your relatives. When you were a witchling, your father searched the lands for you. He never stopped loving your mother. Loving her," she spat, "and loving you. So I killed him." Manon gazed at the drop below, the death that beckoned. "His despair was delicious when I told him what I'd done to her, what I would make you into. Not a child of peace, but war." "Made, made, made." Manon's iron nails chipped on the dark stone of the balcony rail. And then her grandmother said the words that broke her. "Do you know why that Kraken was spying in the Farian Gap this spring? She had been sent to find you. After 116 years of searching, they had finally learned the identity of their dead prince's lost child." Her grandmother's smile was hideous in its absolute triumph. Manon willed strength to her arms, to her legs. "Her name was Rhiannon, after the last Kraken queen, and she was your half-sister. She confessed it to me upon our tables. She thought it'd save her life. And when she saw what you had become, she chose to let the knowledge die with her." "I am a Blackbeak," Manon rasped, blood choking her words. Her grandmother took a step, smiling as she crooned. "You are a Kraken. The last of their royal bloodline with the death of your sister at your own hand. You are a Kraken queen." Absolute silence from the witches gathered. Her grandmother reached for her. "And you're going to die like one by the time I'm finished with you." Manon didn't let her grandmother's nails touch her. A boom sounded nearby. Manon used the strength she'd gathered in her arms, her legs, to hurl herself onto the stone ledge of the balcony and roll off it into the open air. Air and rock and wind and blood. Manon slammed into a warm, leathery hide, screaming as pain from her wounds blacked out her vision. Above, somewhere far away. Her grandmother was shrieking orders. Manon dug her nails into the leathery hide, burying her claws deep. Beneath her, a bark of discomfort she recognized. Abraxos. But she held firm, and he embraced the pain as he banked to the side, swerving out of Morath's shadow. She felt them around her. Manon managed to open her eyes, flicking the clear lid against the wind into place. Etta and Briar, her shadows, were now flanking her. She knew they'd been there, waiting in the shadows with their wyverns, had heard every one of those damning last words. "The others have flown ahead. We were sent to retrieve you," Etta, the eldest of the sisters, shouted over the roar of the wind. "Your wound..."
"It's shallow,"
Manon snapped, forcing the pain aside to focus on the task at hand. She was on Abraxos's neck, the saddle a few feet behind her. One by one, every breath in agony, she released her nails from his skin and slid toward the saddle. He evened out his flight, offering smooth air to buckle herself into the harness. Blood leaked from the gouges in her belly. Soon the saddle was slick with it. Behind them, several roars set the mountains trembling.
"We can't let them get to the others,"
Manon managed to say. Briar, black hair streaming behind her, swept in closer.
"Six yellow legs on our tail, from Iskra's personal coven, closing in fast."
With a score to settle, they'd no doubt be given free rein to slaughter them. Manon surveyed the peaks and ravines of the mountains around them.
"Two apiece,"
she ordered. The shadow's black wyverns were enormous, skilled at stealth, but devastating in a fight.
"Etta, you drive two to the west. Briar, you slam the other two to the east. Leave the last two to me."
No sign of the rest of the 13 in the gray clouds or mountains. Good. They had gotten away. It was enough.
"You kill them. Then you find the others,"
Manon ordered, an arm draped over her wound.
"But Wingleader..."
The title almost sapped her will, but Manon barked,
"That's an order."
The shadows bowed their heads. Then, as if sharing one mind, one heart, they banked to either direction, peeling away from Manon like petals in the wind. Bloodhounds on a scent, four yellow legs split from their group to deal with each shadow. The two in the center flew faster, harder, spreading apart to close in on Manon. Her vision blurred. Not a good sign. Not a good sign at all. She breathed to Abraxos.
"Let's make it a final stand worthy of song."
He bellowed an answer. The yellow legs swept near enough for Manon to count their weapons. A battle cry shattered from the one to her right. Manon dug her left heel into Abraxos's side. Like a shooting star, he blasted down toward the peaks of the Ashy Mountains. The yellow legs dove with them. Manon aimed for a ravine running through the spine of the mountain range, her vision flashing black and white and foggy. A chill crept into her bones. The walls of the ravine closed around them like the maw of a mighty beast, and she pulled on the reins once. Abraxos flung out his wings and coasted along the side of the ravine before catching a current and leveling out, flapping like hell through the heart of the crevasse, pillars of stone jutting from the floor like lances. The yellow legs, too ensnared in their bloodlust, their wyverns too large and bulky, balked at the ravine, at the sharp turn. A boom and a screech, and the whole ravine shuddered. Manon swallowed her bark of agony to peer behind. One of the wyverns had panicked, too big for the space, and slammed into a stone column. Broken bone and blood rained down. But the other wyvern had managed to bank, and now sailed toward them, wings so wide they nearly grazed either side of the ravine. Manon panted through her bloody teeth.
"Fly, Abraxos!"
and her gentle warrior-hearted mount flew. Manon focused on keeping to the saddle, on keeping the arm pressed against her wound to hold the blood in, keep that lethal cold away. She'd gotten enough injuries to know her grandmother had struck deep and true. The ravine swerved right, and Abraxos took the turn with expert skill. She prayed for the boom and roar of the pursuing wyvern to hit the walls, but none came. But Manon knew these deadly canyons. She'd flown this path countless times on the endless inane patrols these months. The Yellowlegs, sequestered in the Farian Gap, did not.
"To the very end, Abraxos," she said.
His roar was his only confirmation. One shot. She'd have one shot. Then she could gladly die, knowing the 13 wouldn't be pursued. Not today, at least. Turn after turn, Abraxos hurtled through the ravine, snapping his own tail against the rock to send debris flying into the Yellowleg sentinel. The rider dodged the rocks, her wyvern bobbing on the wind. Closer. Manon needed her closer. She tugged on Abraxos's reins, and he checked his speed. Turn after turn after turn, black rock flashing by, blurring like her own fading vision. The Yellowlegs was near enough to throw a dagger. Manon looked over a shoulder with her failing eyesight, in time to see her do just that. Not one dagger, but two, metal gleaming in the dim canyon light. Manon braced herself for the impact of metal in flesh and bone. Abraxos took the final turn as the sentinel hurled her daggers at Manon. A towering, impenetrable wall of black stone arose, mere feet away. But Abraxos soared up, catching the updraft and sailing out of the heart of the ravine, so close Manon could touch the dead-end wall. The two daggers struck the rock where Manon had been moments before. And the Yellowleg sentinel, on her bulky, heavy wyvern, did as well. Rock groaned as wyvern and rider splattered against it, and fell to the ravine floor. Panting, her breath a wet, bloody rasp, Manon patted Abraxos's side. Even the motion was feeble.
"Good,"
she managed to say. Mountains became small again. Oakwald spread before her. Trees. The cover of trees might hide her.
"Oak,"
she rasped. Manon didn't finish the command before the darkness swept in to claim her. Chapter 19. Elite Lachen kept quiet during the 2 days she and Lorkin trekked through the eastern edges of Oakwald, heading for the plains beyond. She had not asked him the questions that seemed to matter the most, letting him think her a foolish girl, blinded by gratitude that he had saved her. He'd quickly forgotten that though he'd carried her out, she'd saved herself. And he'd accepted her name, her mother's name, without question. If Vernon was on her trail, it had been a fool's mistake. But there was no undoing it, not without raising Lorkin's suspicions. So she kept her mouth shut, swallowed her questions, like why he'd been hunting her, or who his mistress was to command such a powerful warrior, why he wanted to get into Morath, why he kept touching some object beneath his dark jacket, and why he had looked so surprised, though he'd tried to hide it, when she'd mentioned Selena Sardothian and Aelin Galathinius. Elid had no doubt the warrior was keeping secrets of his own, and that despite his promise to protect her, the moment he got every answer he needed, that protection would end. But she still slept soundly these last 2 nights, thanks to the belly full of meat courtesy of Lorkin's hunting. He'd scrounged up 2 rabbits, and when she'd devoured all of hers in minutes, he'd given her half of what was left of his. She hadn't bothered being polite by refusing. It was mid-morning by the time the light in the forest turned brighter, the air fresher, and then the roaring of mighty waters, the Acanthus,
Lorkin stalked ahead, and Aleid could have sworn even the trees leaned away from him as he held up a hand in a silent motion to wait. She obeyed, lingering in the gloom of the trees, praying he wouldn't make them return to the tangle of Oakwald, that she wouldn't be denied this step into the bright, wide, open world. Lorkin motioned again to come forward. All was clear. Aleid was silent as she stepped, blinking at the flood of sunshine, from the last line of trees to stand beside Lorkin on a high, rocky riverbank. The river was enormous, shades of rushing gray and brown, the last of the ice melt from the mountains. So wide and wild that she knew she could not swim it, and that the crossing had to be somewhere else. But past the river, as if the water were a boundary between two worlds. Hills and meadows of high emerald grasses swayed on the other side of the acanthus, like a hissing sea under a cloudless blue sky, stretching away forever to the horizon. "I can't remember," she murmured, the words barely audible over the roaring song of the river. "The last time I saw..." In Perenth, locked in that tower, she'd only had a view of the city, perhaps the lake if the day was clear enough. Then she'd been in that prison wagon, then in Morath, where it was only mountains and ash and armies. And during the fight with Manon and Abraxos, she had been too lost in terror and grief to notice anything at all. But now, she could not remember the last time she'd seen sunlight dancing on a meadow, or little brown birds bobbing and swooping on the warm breeze over it.
"The road is about a mile upriver," Lorkin said, his dark eyes unmoved by the acanthus or the rippling grasses beyond. "If you want your plan to work, now would be the time to prepare."
She cut him a glance. "You need the most work." A flick of black brows. Aleid clarified, "If this ruse is to succeed, you at least need to pretend to be human." Nothing about the man suggested his human heritage held sway. "Hide more of your weapons," she went on. "Leave only the sword." Even the mighty blade would be a dead giveaway that Lorkin was no ordinary traveler. She fished an extra strap of leather out of her jacket pocket. "Tie back your hair. You'll look less..." She trailed off at the faint amusement tinged with warning in his eyes. "Savage," she made herself say, dangling the leather strap between them. Lorkin's broad fingers closed around it, a frown on his lips as he obeyed. "And unbutton your jacket," she said, rummaging through her mental catalog of traits she had noted seemed less threatening, less intimidating. Lorkin obeyed that order, too, and soon the dark gray shirt beneath his tight-fitting black jacket was showing, revealing the broad, muscled chest. It looked more inclined for solid labor than killing fields, at least.
"And you,"
he said, brows still high. Aleid surveyed herself and set down her pack. First, she removed the leather jacket, even though it left her feeling like a layer of skin had peeled off. Then she rolled up the sleeves of her white shirt. But without the tight leather, the full size of her breasts could be seen, marking her as a woman and not a slip of a girl that people assumed she was. She then took to her hair, ruffling it out of its braid and wrestling it into a knot atop her head. A married woman's hairstyle, not the free-flowing locks or plait of youth. She stuffed her jacket into her pack, standing up straight to face Lorkin. His eyes traveled from her feet to her head, and he frowned again.
"Bigger tits won't prove or hide anything."
Her cheeks heated.
"Perhaps they'll keep men distracted just enough that they won't ask questions."
With that, she started upstream, trying not to think about the men who had touched and sneered in that cell. But if it got her safely across the river, she'd use her body to her advantage.
Men would see what they wanted to. A pretty young woman who did not bristle at their attention, who spoke kindly and warmly. Someone trustworthy. Someone sweet yet unremarkable. Lorcan trailed, then caught up to walk beside her like an actual companion and not some promise-bound escort for the final half-mile around the bend of the river. Horses and wagons and shouts greeted them before the sight did. But there it was, a broad if worn stone bridge, wagons and carts and riders lined up in droves on either side, and about 2 dozen guards in Otterlanian colors, monitoring either bank, collecting tolls, and checking wagons, inspecting every face and person. The Ilkin had known about her limp. Elide slowed, keeping close to Lorcan as they neared the 2-story derelict barracks on their side of the river. Down the road, flanked by the trees, a few equally sorry-looking buildings were a flurry of activity, an inn and a tavern. For travelers to wait out the lines with a drink or meal, or perhaps rent a room during inclement weather. So many people. Humans. No one appeared panicked or hurt or sickly. And the guards, despite their uniforms, moved like men while they searched the wagons passing the barracks that served as toll house and sleeping quarters. She said quietly to Lorcan as they headed for the dirt road and the distant back of the line, "I don't know what magic you possess, but if you can make my limp less noticeable." Before she could finish, a force like a cool night wind pushed against her ankle and calf, then wrapped around it in a solid grip. A brace. Her steps evened out, and she had to bite back her urge to gawk at the feeling of walking straight and sure. She didn't allow herself to enjoy it, savor it, not when it would likely only last until they cleared the bridge. Merchants' wagons idled, crammed with goods from those who hadn't wanted to risk the Avery River to the north, their drivers tight-faced at the wait and impending inspections. Elide scanned the drivers, the merchants, the other travelers. Each one of them made her instincts shout that they'd be betrayed the second they asked to ride or offered a coin to keep quiet. To trawl the line would catch the eye of the guards, so Elide used every step to study it while seemingly heading toward the back. But she reached the end of the line empty-handed. Lorcan, however, gave a pointed glance behind her, toward the tavern, whitewashed to no doubt hide the near-crumbling stones.
"Let's get a bite before we wait," he said,
loud enough for the wagon in front of them to hear and dismiss it. She nodded. Someone else might be inside, and her stomach was grumbling. Except, "I don't have any money," she murmured as they approached the pale wooden door. Lie. She had gold and silver from Manon, but she wasn't about to flash it in front of Lorcan, promise or no.
"I've got plenty," he said tightly,
and she delicately cleared her throat. He lifted his brows.
"You'll win us no allies looking like that," she said,
and gave him a sweet little smile.
"Walk in there looking like a warrior, and you'll get noticed."
"And what am I to be, then?"
"Whatever we need you to be when the time comes. But don't glower."
He opened the door, and by the time her eyes adjusted to the glow of the wrought-iron chandeliers, Lorcan's face had changed. His eyes might never be warm, but a bland smile was on his face, his shoulders relaxed, as if he were slightly inconvenienced by the wait but eager for a good meal. He almost looked human. The tavern was packed, the noise so deafening that she could barely speak loudly enough to the nearest barmaid to order lunch. They squeezed between crammed tables, and Elide noticed that more than a few pairs of eyes went to her chest, then her face, and lingered. She pushed against the crawling feeling and kept her steps unhurried, as she aimed for a table tucked against the back wall that a weary-looking couple had just vacated. A boisterous party of eight was crammed around the table a few feet away, a middle-aged woman with a booming laugh instantly singling herself out as their leader. The others at the table, a beautiful raven-haired woman, a barrel-chested bearded man whose hands were as large as dinner plates, and a few rough-looking people, all kept looking to the older woman, gauging her responses and listening carefully to what she had to say. Elide slid into the worn wooden chair, Lorkin claiming the one across from her, his size earning him a look from the bearded man and the middle-aged woman at the table. Elide weighed that look. Assessment. Not for a fight, not for a threat, but in appreciation and calculation. Elide wondered for a heartbeat if Aneth herself had nudged that other couple to move away, to free up this one table for them, for that very look. Elide laid her hand out on the table, palm up, and gave Lorkin a sleepy smile she'd once seen a kitchen maid give a Morath cook. "Husband," she said sweetly, wriggling her fingers. Lorkin's mouth tightened, but he took her hand, her fingers dwarfed in his. His calluses scraped against her own. He noticed it at the same moment she did, sliding his hand to cup hers so he might inspect her palm. She closed her hand, rotating it to grip his again.
"Brother," Lorkin murmured so no one else could hear. "I am your brother."
"You are my husband," she said with equal quiet. "We have been married 3 months. Follow my lead."
He glanced around, not having noticed the assessing stare they'd been given. Doubt still danced in his eyes, along with a silent question. She said simply,
"Men will not fear the threat of a brother. I would still be unclaimed, still be open for invitations. I have seen how little respect men have for anything they think they are entitled to. So you are my husband," she hissed, "until I say otherwise."
A shadow flickered in Lorkin's eyes, along with another question, one she didn't want to and couldn't answer. His hand tightened on hers, demanding she look at him. She refused. Their food arrived, mercifully, before Lorkin could ask it. Stew. Root vegetables and rabbit. She dug in, nearly melting the roof of her mouth at the first bite. The group behind them began talking again, and she listened as she ate, selecting bits and pieces as if they were shells on a shore.
"Maybe we'll offer them a performance, and they'll cut the toll fee in half,"
from the blonde, bearded man. "Unlikely," the leader said. "Those pricks would charge us to perform. Worse, they enjoy our performance and demand we stay a while. We can't afford that wait, not when other companies are already on the move. We don't want to hit all the plains towns after everyone else."
Elide almost choked on her stew. Aneth must have freed this table, then. Her plan had been to find a trooper carnival to fall into, disguise themselves as workers. And this... "We pay full price on that toll," the beautiful woman said, "and we might get to that first town half-starved and barely able to perform at all."
Elide lifted her eyes to Lorkin's. He gave a nod. She took a sip of her stew, steeling herself, thinking of Aster and Blackbeak. Charming, confident, fearless. She'd always had her head at a jaunty angle, a looseness to her limbs, a hint of a smile on her lips. Elide took a breath, letting those memories sink into muscle and flesh and bone. Then she pivoted in her chair, an arm draped around the back, as she leaned toward their table and said with a grin,
"Sorry to interrupt your meal, but I couldn't help but overhear your conversation."
They all turned toward her, brows high, the eyes of the leader going right to Elide's face. She saw the assessment. Young, pretty,
unblemished by a hard life.
Elide kept her own expression pleasant,
willed her eyes to brighten.
Are you some sort of performing troupe?
She motioned to Lorcan with a tilt of her head.
My husband and I have been looking to fall in with one for weeks, with no luck. Everyone's full.
So are we, their leader said.
Right,
Elide replied merrily.
But that toll is steep, for anyone. And if we were to be in business together, perhaps on a temporary basis...
Lorcan's knee brushed hers in warning. She ignored him.
We'd be glad to chip in on the fee, make up any difference owed.
The woman's assessment turned wary. We are a carnival indeed, but we have no need of new members. The bearded man and beautiful woman shot glances at the woman, reprimand in their eyes. Elide shrugged.
All right, then. But in case you change your mind before you depart, my husband,
a gesture to Lorcan, who was giving his best attempt at an easy smile,
is an expert sword thrower, and in our previous troop, he made good coin matching himself against men who sought to best him in feats of strength.
The leader turned her keen eyes on Lorcan, on the height and muscles and posture. Elide knew she'd guessed right on the vacancy they'd needed filled, when the woman said to her, And what did you do for them?
I worked as a fortune teller. They called me their oracle.
A shrug.
Mostly just shadows and guesswork.
It'd have to be, considering the little fact that she couldn't read. The woman remained unimpressed. And what was your troop's name?
They likely knew them, knew every troop that patrolled the plains.
She scanned her memory for anything helpful,
anything.
Yellowlegs. The witches in Morath had once mentioned Baba Yellowlegs, who had traveled in a carnival to avoid detection, who had died in Rifthold this winter with no explanation. Detail after detail, buried in the catacombs of her memory, poured out.
We were in the Carnival of Mirrors, Elide said.
Recognition, surprise, respect sparked in the leader's eyes.
Until Baba Yellowlegs, our owner, was killed in Rifthold this past winter. We left, and have been looking for work since.
Where did you come from, then?
The bearded man asked. It was Lorcan who replied.
My family lives on the western side of the Fangs. We've spent the past few months with them, waited until the snows melted, since the pass was so treacherous. Strange things happening,
he added,
in the mountains these days.
The company stilled.
Indeed,
the raven-haired woman said. She looked to their leader.
They could help pay the toll, Molly. And since Saul left, that act has been empty.
Likely their sword thrower.
Like I said,
Elide chimed in with Asterin's pretty smile.
We'll be here for a little while, so if you change your minds, let us know. If not,
she saluted with her dented spoon.
Safe travels.
Something flashed in Molly's eyes, but the woman looked them over once more.
Safe travels, she murmured.
Elide and Lorcan returned to their meal. And when the barmaid came to take their money for it, Elide reached into her inner pocket and pulled out a silver coin. The barmaid's eyes were wide, but it was the sharp eyes of Molly, of the others at that table, that Elide noted, as the girl slipped away and brought back their change. Lorcan kept silent as Elide left a generous tip on the table, but they both offered pleasant smiles to the troop as they vacated their table and the tavern. Elide went right to the back of the line, still keeping that smile on her face, her back straight. Lorcan sidled up close, not at all noteworthy for the front they were putting on.
You have no money, do you?
She gave him a sidelong glance.
Looks like I was mistaken, a flash of white teeth as he smiled, genuinely this time.
Well, you'd better hope you and I have enough, Marion, because Molly's about to make you an offer.
Elide turned at the crunch of dirt beneath black boots and found Molly before them, the others lingering, some slipping around the corner of the tavern to no doubt retrieve the wagons. Molly's hard face was flushed, as if they'd been arguing, but she just clicked her tongue and said,
"Temporary stint. If you're shit, you're out, and we won't pay back the money for the toll."
Elide smiled, not entirely faking it. "Marion and Lorcan, at your service, madam."
His wife. Gods above.
He was over 500 years old, and this
girl, young woman, she-devil, whatever she was, had just bluffed and lied her way into a job. A sword-thrower indeed.
Lorcan lingered outside the tavern, Marion at his side. A small troop, hence the lack of funds, and one that had seen better days, he realized, as the two yellow-painted wagons clattered and wobbled into view, pulled by four nags. Marion carefully observed Molly climb into the driver's seat beside the raven-haired beauty, who paid Lorcan absolutely no heed.
Well, having Marion as his god's damned wife certainly put an end to anything more than appreciation of the stunning woman. It was an effort not to growl. He hadn't been with a woman in months now. And of course he'd have the time and interest in one, only to be shackled by another one's lies. His wife.
Not that Marion was hard on the eyes, he noted, as she obeyed Molly's barked order to climb into the back of the second wagon. Some of the other party members followed on piss-poor horses. Marion took the bearded man's extended hand, and he easily hauled her into the wagon. Lorcan trailed, assessing everyone in the party, everyone in the makeshift little town. A number of men, and some women, had noticed Marion when she strode by. The sweet face paired with sinful curves, and without the limp, with her hair out of her face. She knew exactly what she was doing. Knew people would notice those things, think about those things, instead of the cunning mind and lies she fed them. Lorcan ignored the hand the bearded man offered, and jumped into the back of the wagon, reminding himself to sit close to Marion, to put an arm around her bony shoulders, and look relieved and happy to have a troop again. Supplies filled the wagon, along with five other people who all smiled at Marion, and then quickly looked away from him. Marion put a hand on his knee, and Lorcan avoided the urge to flinch. It had been a shock earlier, to feel how rough those delicate hands were. Not just a prisoner in Morath, but a slave. The calluses were old and dense enough that she'd likely worked for years. Hard labor from the looks of it. And with that ruined leg. He tried not to think about that tang of fear and pain he'd sensed when she told him how little she believed in the kindness and decency of men. He didn't let his imagination delve too deep regarding why she might feel that way. The wagon was hot, the air soaked with human sweat, hay, the shit of the horses lined up before them, the tang of iron from the weapons.
"Not much by way of belongings?" asked the bearded man.
Nick, he'd called himself. Shit. He'd forgotten humans traveled with baggage as if they were moving somewhere. "We lost most of it on our trip out of the mountains. My husband," Marion said with charming annoyance, "insisted we ford a rushing stream. I'm lucky he even bothered to help me out, since he certainly didn't go after our supplies." A low chuckle from Nick.
"I suspect he was more focused on saving you than on the packs."
Marion rolled her eyes, patting Lorcan's knee. He nearly cringed at every touch. Even with his lovers, outside the bed itself, he didn't like casual, careless contact. Some found that intolerable. Some thought they could break him into a decent male who just wanted a home and a good female to work beside him. Not one of them had succeeded. "I can save myself," Marion said brightly. "But his throwing swords, our cooking supplies, my clothes..." A shake of the head. "His act might be a bit lackluster until we can find somewhere to purchase more supplies." Nick met Lorcan's eyes, holding them for longer than most men dared. What he did for the carnival, Lorcan wasn't sure. Sometime performer, but definitely security. Nick's smile faded a bit.
"The land beyond the Fangs isn't kind. Your people must be hardy folk to live out there."
Lorcan nodded.
"A rougher life," he said, "than I want for my wife." "Life on the road isn't much better," Nick countered.
"Ah," Marion chimed in, "but isn't it? A life of open skies and roads, of wandering where the wind takes you, answering to no one and nothing. A life of freedom." She shook her head. "What more could I ask than to live a life unchecked by cages?" Lorcan knew the words were no lie. He had seen her face when they beheld the grassy plain.
"Spoken like someone who has spent long enough on the road," Nick said. "It always goes either way with our kind. You settle down and never travel again, or you wander forever."
"I want to see life, see the world," Marion said, her voice softening. "I want to see everything."
Lorcan wondered if Marion would even get to do that, if he failed in his task, if the word key he carried wound up in the wrong hands.
"Best not wander too far," Nick said, frowning. "Not with what happened in Rifthold, or what's brewing down in Morath." "What happened in Rifthold?"
Lorcan cut in, sharply enough that Marion squeezed his knee. Nick idly scratched his wheat-colored beard.
"Whole city's been sacked. Overrun, they say, by flying terrors and demon women as their riders. Witches, if one is to believe the rumors. Iron Teeth, straight out of legend."
A shudder. Holy gods.
The destruction would have been a sight to behold. Lorcan forced himself to listen, to concentrate, and not begin calculating casualties and what it would mean for this war, as Nick continued.
"No word on the young king, but the city belongs to the witches and their beasts. They say to travel north is to now face a death trap. To travel south is another death trap. So," a shrug, "we'll head east. Maybe we can find a way to bypass whatever's waiting in either direction. Maybe war will come and we'll all scatter to the winds."
Nick looked him over.
"Men like you and me might be conscripted."
Lorcan bit back a dark chuckle. No one could force him into anything, save for one person, and she...
His chest tightened. It was best not to think of his queen. "You think either side would do that? Force men to fight?"
Marion's words were breathless.
"Don't know,"
Nick said, the scent and sound of the river now overwhelming enough that Lorcan knew they were near the toll. He reached into his jacket for the money Molly had demanded. Far more than their fair share, but he didn't care. These people could go to hell the moment they were safely hidden deep in the endless plains.
"Duke Parrington's forces might not even want us, if they've got witches and beasts on their side."
"And much worse," Lorcan wanted to say. "Wordhounds and Ilkin and the gods knew what."
"But Aelin Galathinius?"
Nick mused. Marion's hand went limp on Lorcan's knee.
"Who knows what she will do? She has not called for aid, has not asked soldiers to come to her. Yet she held Rifthold in her grip, killed the king, destroyed his castle, but gave the city back.
The bench beneath them groaned as Marion leaned forward. What do you know of Aelin?
Rumors, here and there,
Nick said, shrugging.
They say she's beautiful as sin, and colder than ice. They say she's a tyrant, a coward, a whore. They say she's God's blessed or God's damned. Who knows? 19 seems awfully young to have such burdens. Rumor claims her court is strong, though. A shapeshifter guards her back, and 2 warrior princes flank her on either side.
Lorcan thought of that shapeshifter, who had so unceremoniously vomited not once, but twice all over him. Thought of those 2 warrior princes, one of them Gavriel's son.
Will she save or damn us all?
Nick considered, now monitoring the snaking line behind their wagon.
I don't know if I much like the thought of everything resting in her hands. But if she wins, perhaps the land will get better. Life will get better. And if she fails, perhaps we all deserve to be damned anyway.
She will win, Marion said with quiet strength. Nick's brows rose. Men shouted, and Lorcan said,
I'd save talk of her for another time.
Boots crunched, and then uniformed men were peering into the back of the wagon.
Out,
one ordered.
Line up.
The man's eyes snagged on Marion. Lorcan's arm tightened around her, as an ugly, too familiar light filled the soldier's eyes.
Lorcan bit back his snarl as he said to her, Come, wife.
The soldier noticed him then. The man backed away a step, a bit pale, then ordered the supplies be searched. Lorcan jumped out first, bracing his hands on Marion's waist as he helped her off the wagon. When she made a step away, he tugged her back against him, an arm across her abdomen. He met each soldier's stare as they passed and wondered who was looking after the dark-haired beauty in the front. A moment later, she and Molly came around. A dark rimmed hat was slung over the beauty's head, half of her light brown face obscured, her body concealed in a heavy coat that drew the eye away from any feminine curves. Even the cast of her mouth was unpleasant, as if the woman had slipped into another person's skin entirely. Still, Molly nudged the woman between Lorcan and Nick, then took the money pouch from Lorcan's free hand without so much as a thank you. The dark-haired beauty leaned forward to murmur to Marion,
Don't look them in the eye, and don't talk back.
Marion nodded, chin dipping as she focused on the ground. Against him, he could feel her racing heart, wild, despite the calm submission written over every line of her body.
And you?
The beauty hissed at him, as the soldiers searched their wares and took what they wanted.
Molly says if you get into a fight, you're gone, and we're not bailing you out of prison. So let them talk and laugh, but don't interfere.
Lorcan debated saying he could slaughter this entire garrison if he pleased, but nodded. After 5 minutes, another order was shouted. Molly handed over Lorcan's money and her own to pay the toll, plus more for expedited passage. Then they were all back in the wagon again, none of them daring to see what had been pilfered. Marion was shaking slightly against where he kept her tucked into his side. But her face was blank, bored. The guards hadn't so much as questioned them, hadn't asked after a woman with a limp. The acanthus roared beneath them as they crossed the bridge, wagon wheels clattering on ancient stones. Marion kept shaking. Lorcan studied her face again, the hint of red along her high cheekbones, her tight mouth. Not shaking from fear, he realized, as he caught a whiff of her scent. A slight tang of it, perhaps, but mostly something red-hot, something wild and raging and anger. It was boiling rage that made her shake, at the inspection, at the leering of the guards. An idealist. That's what Marion was. Someone who wanted to fight for her queen, who believed, as Nick did, that this world could be better. As they cleared the other side of the bridge, the soldiers letting them pass without fuss, as they meandered past the line on that side and emerged onto the plains themselves, Lorcan wondered at that anger, at that belief in a better world. He didn't feel like telling either Marion or Nick that their dream was a fool's one. Marion relaxed enough to peer out the back of the wagon, at the grasses flanking the wide dirt road, at the blue sky, at the roaring river and the looming sprawl of Oakwald behind them. And for all her rage, a tentative sort of wonder grew in her dark eyes. He ignored it. Lorcan had seen the worst and best in men for 500 years. There was no such thing as a better world, no such thing as a happy end, because there were no endings. And there would be nothing waiting for them in this war. Nothing waiting for an escaped slave girl, but a shallow grave. Chapter 20. Rowan Whitethorn just needed a place to rest. He didn't give a shit if it was a bed, or a pile of hay, or even beneath a horse in a stable. As long as it was quiet, and there was a roof to keep out the driving veils of rain, he didn't care. Skull's Bay was what he expected, and yet not. Ramshackle buildings, painted every color but mostly in cracking disrepair, were bustling, as residents shuttered windows and hauled in clotheslines against the storm that had chased Rowan and Dorian into the harbor minutes ago. Hooded and cloaked, no one had asked them any questions once Rowan had flipped a 5-copper mark to the dockmaster. Enough to keep his mouth shut, but not enough to warrant any of the would-be thieves monitoring the docks to come after them. Dorian had mentioned twice now that he wasn't sure how Rowan was still functioning. To be honest, Rowan wasn't either. He'd allowed himself to doze only for hours at a time over the past few days. The burnout loomed, steadily fraying his grip on his magic, his focus. When Rowan hadn't been wrangling the winds to propel their skiff through the vibrant warm waters of the Dead Islands archipelago, he'd been soaring high above to monitor for approaching enemies. He'd seen none. Just turquoise ocean and white sands flecked with dark volcanic stone. All of it ringing the dense emerald foliage crusting mountainous islands that spread as far as even a hawk's eye could see. Thunder grumbled across Skull's Bay, and the turquoise sea beyond the harbor seemed to glow brighter, as if a distant lightning strike had lit up the entire ocean. Along the docks, a cobalt-painted tavern remained lightly guarded, even with the storm bearing down on them. The Sea Dragon. Rolf's own headquarters, named after his ship, from Aelin's reports. Rowan debated going right up to it, no more than 2 lost travelers seeking shelter from the storm. But he and the young king had chosen another route, during the many hours he'd made good on his promise to teach Dorian about magic. They'd worked for only minutes at a time, since it'd be no use if the king wrecked their little boat should his power slip its leash. So it had been exercises with ice, summoning a ball of frost to his palm, letting it melt, over and over. Even now, standing like a stone amid the stream of people hauling in wares from the storm's fury, the king was curling and relaxing his fingers, letting Rowan glean their bearings while he gazed across the horseshoe-shaped bay to the colossal chain stretched across its mouth, currently beneath the surface. Shipbreaker, the chain was called.
crusted with barnacles and draped in scarves of seaweed. It was connected to a watchtower on either side of the bay, where guards would raise and lower the chain to let ships out, or keep ships in until they'd paid the hefty tolls. They'd been lucky that the chain had already been lowered in anticipation of the storm. Since their plan for announcing themselves would be calm, diplomatic, which it would need to be, given that the last time Aelin had set foot in Skull's Bay, 2 years ago, she'd wrecked that chain and taken out one of the now rebuilt watchtowers. Rolf, it seemed, had added a sister tower across the bay since then, plus half the town, and disabled the rudders on every ship in the harbor, including Rolf's prized one, the Sea Dragon. Rowan wasn't surprised, but seeing the scope of the hell she had unleashed, holy gods. So Dorian's announcement of his arrival would be the opposite of that. They'd take rooms at a reputable inn, and then request an audience with Rolf, proper and dignified. Lightning flashed, and Rowan swiftly scanned the street ahead, a hand gripping his hood to keep the wind from revealing his fey heritage. An emerald-painted inn lay at the other end of the block, its gilded sign clacking in the wild wind. The Ocean Rose. The nicest inn in town, the dockmaster had claimed when they asked, since they at least needed to appear like they could make good on the money they'd offer Rolf. And get some rest, if only for a few hours. Rowan stepped toward it, nearly sagging with relief, and looked over a shoulder to motion the king to follow. But as if the gods themselves wanted to test him, a gust of rain-cooled wind sprayed into their faces, and some sense pricked in its wake. A shift in the air, like a great pocket of power gathered close, beckoning. The knife at his side was instantly in his soaked hand as he searched the rooftops, revealing only plumes of rain. Rowan quieted his mind, listening to the city and storm around them. Dorian swept his dripping hair out of his face, mouth open to speak, until he noted the knife.
"You feel it, too."
Rowan nodded, rain sliding down his nose.
"What do you sense?"
The king's raw power might pick up different feelings, different clues, than what his wind and ice and instinct could detect. But without the training, it might not be clear.
"It feels old."
Dorian winced and said over the storm,
"Feral. Ruthless. I can't glean anything more."
"Does it remind you of the Vog?"
If there was one person who'd know, it'd be the king before him.
"No,"
Dorian said, gaze shuddering.
"They were abhorrent to my magic. This thing out there, it just makes my magic curious. Wary, but curious. But it's concealed. Somehow."
Rowan sheathed his knife.
"Then stay close, and keep alert."
Dorian had never been in such a place as Skull's Bay. Even with the heavy rain lashing them, as they hunted the source of that power down the main street, he'd marveled at the blend of lawlessness and complete order of the island city. It bowed to no king of royal blood, yet was ruled by a pirate lord who had clawed his way to power, thanks to hands tattooed with a map of the world's oceans. A map, rumor claimed, that had revealed where enemies, treasure, and storms awaited him. The cost? His eternal soul. Aelin had once confirmed that Rolf was indeed soulless and indeed tattooed. As for the map, she'd shrugged, saying Rolf claimed it stopped moving when magic fell. Dorian wondered if that map now indicated that he and Rowan walked through his city, if it marked them as enemies. Perhaps Aelin's arrival would be known well before she set foot on this island. Cloaked and hooded and thoroughly soaked, Dorian and Rowan made a wide circuit of the surrounding streets. People had quickly vanished, and the ships in the